Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, Act I. If music be the food of love, play on. Duke Orsino and Countess Olivia follow their separate courses, the one idealizing love and the other idealizing mourning. In Act I, Scene I, Duke Orsino of Illyria and Countess Olivia are both creatures of idealistic excess, determined to pursue their passions. He dedicates himself to loving her, and she swears to mourn her departed brother for 7 years. Olivia, says Valentine, means to, quote-unquote, season a dead brother's love, which she would keep fresh and lasting in her sad remembrance. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 29 through 31. Duke Orsino claims that he would surfeit himself with love to be rid of it, in the same way that overindulgence in food generates disgust with eating. Quote unquote, if music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it that surfeiting the appetite may sicken and so die. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 1 through 3. But in truth, Orsino seems to be in love with love, not with the flesh and blood woman he courts. He is an aesthete, a proto-decadent style chemist working with emotions, and his desire is to live in a realm removed from time, chance, and change. Ironically, he will soon represent his love of Olivia as turning inwardly destructive, like, quote-unquote, fell and cruel hounds pursuing him as if he were Actaeon turned to a stag. Act 1, Scene 2, line 21. Both Orsino and Olivia, with their stylized ideals of love and filial loyalty, risk getting caught in a trap. Those who overextend the natural course of the passions run this risk. In Act 1, Scene 2 of Hamlet, Claudius and Gertrude offer Hamlet, who can't let his father's death go, reasonable counsel. They admonish the brooding prince that the sorrow afflicting him will soon turn transgressive, even self-destructive. His, quote-unquote, customary suits of solemn black will become a denial of life. True, Illyria is the rarefied realm in which the lover Orsino and the mourner Olivia aim to live, and as Anne Barton suggests in her introduction to Twelfth Night for the Riverside Shakespeare's second edition, there's no need for the play's characters to remove themselves to some distant green world. Illyria flows parallel with desire itself. Still, Shakespeare's characters, like us, won't remain in such a state forever. Time and chance come for all mortals. As the play progresses, Feste, Olivia's fool, will often remind us that our own desires are not the only order with which we must reckon. He neither affirms that desire can be in harmony with the world, nor denies it altogether. That, of course, is the essential question comedy explores. Feste gives a suitably ambivalent answer when, in Act 2, Scene 4, he says to Duke Orsino, quote-unquote, pleasure will be paid one time or another. Act 2, Scene 4, lines 68 through 69. What else may hap, to time I will commit. Viola survives a shipwreck and washes up along the coast of Illyria, where she plans to enter the Duke's service and eventually reveal her true identity. In Act 1, Scene 2, shipwreck survivors Viola and the ship's captain take stock of their situation, and he gives her hope for the survival of her twin brother Sebastian. Quote unquote, I saw your brother, most provident in peril, bind himself, ellipsis, to a strong mast that lived upon the sea. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 11 through 14. Viola admires what the captain says about Olivia's constancy in grief to a lost brother and first thinks to serve her. But when the captain indicates the difficulty of that endeavor, she decides to dress as a young man and serve Duke Orsino. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 35 through 40 inclusive. The main reason she gives for disguising herself so that she, as she says, quote unquote, might not be delivered to the world till I had made mine own occasion mellow what my estate is. Act 1, Scene 2, lines 41 through 43. Viola plans to join the Duke's service as a page, and for the rest, she commits her cause to its future unfolding, saying, quote unquote, "What else may hap, to time I will commit." Act 1, Scene 2, line 59. Viola does not take for granted or dismiss any possible eventuality. Perhaps the best textual authority for this attitude is Ecclesiastes 9:11. Quote unquote, "I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor yet bread to the wise, but time and chance cometh to them all." That's from the Geneva Bible at BibleGateway.com. Viola's determination to commit her hopes to time and chance is a key attitude for Shakespeare's comic heroes and heroines. It can't guarantee an untroubled passage to the desired outcome, but that isn't really the aim. Viola's perspective arises from, and calls for, generosity of spirit. It requires openness to what life brings. Selfish characters lack these qualities, so they try to control everyone and everything around them, a strategy that seldom, if ever, yields happy results. I am sure care's an enemy to life. Olivia's uncle, Sir Toby Belch, schemes to promote Sir Andrew Aguecheek as a suitor to her and enrich himself in the process. In Act 1, Scene 3, we learn that Sir Toby Belch operates on a different principle from the ones enunciated by Countess Olivia and Viola. This principle leads Toby to betray his impatience with his illustrious relative. Quote unquote, "What a plague means my niece to take the death of her brother thus? I am sure care's an enemy to life." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 1 through 2. When Mariah tells him, quote unquote, "Confine yourself within the modest limits of order in Olivia's household," Sir Toby scoffs. Quote unquote, "Confine? I'll confine myself no finer than I am. These clothes are good enough to drink in, and so be these boots too." Act 1, Scene 3, lines 7 through 11. Toby, a gourmand and a quote-unquote riotous knight like Jack Falstaff in the Henry IV plays, is committed to the pleasure principle. This self-regarding wildness in Sir Toby doesn't diminish the fun he brings to Twelfth Night, of course, but at times his conduct introduces a note of moral ambiguity that would otherwise be absent. Aside, of course, from Malvolio's patent selfishness. That said, we should also consider Sir Toby's function in a broader context. The Twelfth Night, referenced in the play's title, is January 5th, the last day of the Christmas celebrations that begin on December 25th. This day is followed by the Feast of Epiphany on January 6th, which commemorates the visit of the Magi, or three wise men, to see the infant Jesus. During the Catholic Middle Ages in England, one of the feasts held during this 12-day period was the Feast of Fools, during which a lord and lady of misrule would be chosen with the comic aim of temporarily overturning the social order. While the text of Twelfth Night does not refer directly to the Christmas holiday, the play shares its ambience. Sir Toby, for instance, functions much like a lord of misrule in Twelfth Night, keeping alive the memory of this religious tradition. His role is apparent, and it becomes still clearer when we see him trying to arrange a match between the hapless gentleman Sir Andrew Aguecheek and the splendid Countess Olivia. Incidentally, the difference in rank between them would not be a problem so long as the Countess were to initiate the courtship, as she does with Sebastian. Sir Toby stands for a generalized pursuit of happiness, for a rounding off and leveling of discrimination in choosing the objects of our desires. Desire, in his philosophy, is the key component in a pleasure-yielding system. The point is to be part of the system. Toby insists that Andrew should not hide his talents as a dancer, but should instead use them fully in his courtship. Quote unquote, "Wherefore are these things hid?" asks Toby. Quote unquote, Is it a world to hide virtues in? Act 1, Scene 3, line 112 and lines 117 through 118. Just as Viola's approach to her situation has biblical roots, so does Toby's perspective. See the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, 14 through 30. Who would want to be the quote-unquote unprofitable servant that the Bible condemns? All is semblative a woman's part. Duke Orsino commissions Viola as Cesario to woo Olivia for him. In Act 1, Scene 4, intimacy strikes up immediately between Duke Orsino and Viola, disguised as Cesario. The Duke believes his suit will prosper if he carries it forward by way of Viola Cesario. As he explains, quote-unquote, "It shall become thee well to act my woes. She will attend it better in thy youth." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 25 through 26. Orsino wants Viola Cesario to do all the lover-like things that he himself is failing to do well. Orsino notes Viola Cesario's feminine appearance. Quote-unquote, "Diana's lip is not more smooth and rubious. Thy small pipe is as the maiden's organ, shrill and sound, and all is semblative a woman's part." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 30 through 33. That statement and much else in the play accounts for its interest among queer theory-based critics. Viola realizes at once that her gender disguise has become a trap. Quote-unquote, "I'll do my best to woo your lady," she says to the Duke, but as an aside to us, she admits, quote-unquote, "Yet a barful strife. Whoe'er I woo, myself would be his wife." Act 1, Scene 4, lines 30 through 33, and 40 through 42. "In your denial I would find no sense." Feste discourses on what it means to be a fool, and Olivia falls hard for Cesario. In Act 1, Scene 5, we are introduced to Olivia, Mariah her maid, and Feste, Olivia's fool. Feste's initial words show us yet another perspective on the sway of the passions and the imperfections to which human beings are liable. Quote unquote, "God give them wisdom that have it, and those that are fools let them use their talents," he says to Mariah. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 13 through 14. As the romantic poet William Blake says in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, quote unquote, "If the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise." Feste's foolery is a species of wisdom. It sets him apart, though it does not necessarily result in hostility against his society. We will find that other characters are more immediately subject to the vicissitudes of quote-unquote time and chance. They must shift as they can while Feste himself remains more or less constant. He is at times a participant, but even then he maintains the self-aware stance of an observer. Feste's skill in discourse consists in being able to formulate claims such as the one he throws at Olivia in an attempt to prove she deserves his title. Quote unquote, "Anything that's mended is but patched. Virtue that transgresses is but patched with sin, and sin that amends is but patched with virtue." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 41 through 43. He seems to imply here that moral states are impermanent, which gives his remark a hint of Montaigne's skepticism in essays such as, quote unquote, "of the inconstancy of our actions." Feste considers Olivia a fellow fool because of her over-grieving for the loss of her brother. In her quest for a perfectly stylized mourning, this lovely absolutist risks the decay of her beauty, itself a mode of perfection. Feste understands that in this saucy world there is no permanent strategy. There is only mending of virtues with vices and vice versa. There is accommodation and negotiation between one person and another, and we must always consider the opportunity cost of our choices. Feste's attempt to prove his patron Countess Olivia a fool also constitutes a self-defense, a delineation of the relative value of his perspective, his place in Illyria, as a respected fool. Respected by most, that is, enter the steward Malvolio, Puritan Killjoy, who says to Olivia, quote unquote, "I marvel your ladyship takes delight in such a barren rascal." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 75 through 76. Olivia, however, doesn't approve of Malvolio's rigid virtue. He is filled with self-love, she says, so he can't see that, quote unquote, "there is no slander in an allowed fool, though he do nothing but rail, nor no railing in a known discreet man, though he do nothing but reprove." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 85 through 87. Olivia is also leading Orsino on, curious to see what his next move will be. We'll once more hear Orsino's embassy. Act 1, Scene 5, line 155. Viola Cesario wins Olivia's interest immediately, and her love at first meeting. In the Ovidian manner of attraction, the Countess is struck suddenly, irresistibly, with the youth's beauty and grace. As even Malvolio says, Viola Cesario is a fair youth, one, quote-unquote, "in standing water between boy and man," Act 1, Scene 5, lines 148 through 149. This liminality may be what makes Viola Cesario so attractive to Olivia. He is not a fully grown man like Duke Orsino, but is instead all potential, a being still to be determined. The outcome of the Duke's miscalculation is predictable. Olivia goes for Orsino's eye candy, not for him. The Countess is open to something new, and intimacy is quickly established. Viola Cesario says, with delicious gender irony at the beginning of their conversation, quote unquote, "Good beauties, let me sustain no scorn. I am very comptable, even to the least sinister usage." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 162 through 163. It is men, Viola Cesario implies, who are oversensitive about their reception by others. The passage in which Olivia unveils her face at the request of Viola Cesario is remarkable. Quote unquote, "We will draw the curtain and show you the picture," says the Countess, and she describes her face as an accurate portrait that will, quote unquote, "endure wind and weather." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 214 through 215 and 219. This description is accurate, although it makes sense to hear Feste's song at the play's end as a comment on the limitations of such endurance. Quote unquote, "The wind and the rain are always at work, breaking down what seemed timeless," and we may be reminded of Feste's earlier conversation with Olivia, in which he mused that beauty, ever perishable, is, quote unquote, "a flower." Act 1, Scene 5, line 45. In truth, Olivia first sets herself forth as a work of art and then makes a mockery of the sentiment, offering to give out, quote unquote, "diverse schedules of my beauty, filled with relevant items." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 225 through 227. As the conversation continues, Viola Cesario's rhetorical boldness shows Olivia the way to give in to her own passions. Quote unquote, "If I did love you in my master's flame with such a suffering, such a deadly life, in your denial I would find no sense. I would not understand it." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 246 through 249. By the end of the scene, Olivia will be madly in love and unable to comprehend Viola Cesario's reluctance, so she will have to turn to the stratagem of the ring to ensure the future presence of this new object of her desire. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 282 through 286 inclusive. Her sudden change of heart shows in her final lines of the scene, quote unquote, "Fate, show thy force, ourselves we do not owe. What is decreed must be, and be this so." Act 1, Scene 5, lines 292 through 293. Olivia knows that a great transformation is working inside of her, but like Viola accepting time's dispensation, she welcomes the change. What she doesn't welcome is Orsino's love. Why not? Well, all she says is that Duke Orsino is, quote-unquote, a gracious person, but yet I cannot love him. He might have took his answer long ago. Act 1, Scene 5, lines 244 through 245. Perhaps he's too obviously pursuing her, but a theme of considerable interest in Twelfth Night is its exploration of how we choose our erotic objects, or how they choose us. It may be that Olivia considers herself and Orsino too much alike in their idealistic tendencies. Thanks for listening. The date of this audio recording is Sunday, July 20th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from Twelfth Night, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.